Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this occasional lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. If you want to find out how your parliament is performing, one of the ways of doing this is to invite a knowledgeable foreigner to come and have a look at it and do an assessment of it. It can be quite embarrassing, but on the other hand, it can be quite informative too. And a few years ago, we invited Dr. Stan Bark to come and have a look at our place and do an assessment of it of sorts. And he is a very distinguished person, learned in the ways of legislatures by being in the research service of the Library of Congress for many, many years. And people in the Library of Congress get involved in heavily advising Congress and its committees on their legislative operations. So he's a man of vast knowledge. And he came and had a look at our place and wrote a book. And it's a very, very valuable book, this book here. Unlike all the other books I promote at these sessions, we do have a financial interest in this book. And therefore I urge you all the more earnestly to go and buy a copy.
Is it the gift shop anyway?
It's in the gift shop, as Stan reminds me. So Stan is here with us again to give us a lecture and to do a little update on his assessment of the Senate in particular and the Australian Parliament. Please welcome him to the podium.
Thank you, Harry. It's a pleasure to be back in Canberra. This is a terribly difficult room to work. If any of those of you who are up in the back would be interested in moving further down, we'd be delighted to have you down here. On the other hand, if you prefer being back there, then all I ask is please don't snore. I want to first thank Harry and all of his associates in the Senate for the heartwarming welcome I received when I returned last week. And I apply that even to those of you from the Senate who have told me you are coming here today only for the purpose of heckling and sniggering, and I know who you are. It's just about 5 years, well, it is 5 years this month since I first arrived in Canberra, and 4 years since my second and most recent visit. I always arrange these things so I'm here before Floriade closes. I may look dumb, but I'm not. And it's been a great opportunity to renew the many friendships I had an opportunity to make. The real reason we're here today, of course, has nothing to do with my lecture. We are here to celebrate the 39th birthday of the now retired but finally remembered Deputy Clerk of the House, Anne Lynch. Anne, wave to everybody. Wave to everybody. Don't be shy, Anne. Well, that's the first time in 5 years I've known Anne to be shy and speechless. And I'd also like to express my thanks to my friend Professor John Ewer of the Crawford School of Economics and Government. Do I have that right? Oh, good. Thank you. And a Parliamentary Study Center at the ANU, which has kindly invited me to make this return but all too brief visit. John's from Brisbane, and I was up in Brisbane for the first time a few days before I came down to Canberra. And I was sending an email to a friend back home in Washington, and I found myself writing that, well, tomorrow I'm going to fly to Sydney, and there I'll rent a car and drive home to Canberra. And it wasn't until that message was somewhere across the Pacific that it dawned on me what I had said, and also dawned on me how much I meant just that. You know, I know someone in my position is supposed to begin by saying what a great pleasure it is to be here. Well, if you had seen the silly grin on my face when I was driving down North Burn Avenue on that Friday afternoon, you'd know just how much I mean that. But enough for this maudlin sentimentality. I'm cutting into my own time. I have more to say than undoubtedly I'll have time for, but I've been told to keep it to a minimum so we'll have an opportunity for as much of a conversation as we can in this kind of awful setting. What I want to talk about today grows out of some of the interests that are reflected in the book Harry held up. I think that was probably an unnecessary pitch because I assume all of you have already purchased it and read it with great interest, and it has pride of place on your bookshelves. And my thoughts also follow from a lecture that I presented in the same series, not in this room, in 2003, and I also assume that all of you attended that and remember it with great fondness. More immediately, the themes I'll develop are a continuation, in a sense, of a paper I prepared in anticipation of my visit to John's Parliamentary Studies Center at the ANU. And that paper, which I am now in the process of revising with the benefit of some wonderfully helpful comments I've received and expect to receive from some of the people in this room, examines the final fate of Senate amendments to government bills from 1996, when Mr. Howard became prime minister, through the end of 2005. I won't review those findings in detail because I am still in the process of revising the text. I'm going to want to include information covering at least all of 2007. Talking about data is inescapably boring. So let me just make two comments about it. First, I did find what I take to be evidence of the Senate's influence on legislation in the sense of amendments that the House of Representatives initially rejected, but that ultimately either accepted or that led to other changes in government bills that both houses approved. And the second initial comment I'd make is that all evidence of this kind of influence absolutely disappeared as of a certain date, and I suspect some of you can guess what that date was. 1 July 2005, when the government assumed numerical control of the Senate for the first time since 1981. So, anticipating what I expect to find when I include more recent data, I think it's fair to say that it's already quite clear that the 2004 elections did make a difference in the government's ability to work its will on legislation in this building. There remain, however, two related questions, that the documentary record simply can't answer. During those years that I looked at, from 96 through the middle of 2005, before the senators elected in 2004 took office, was the Senate's impact on legislation a little or a lot? And was it a good thing or a bad? Now, you can't answer these questions simply by looking at the numbers. They don't depend on interpretation of data. They depend more on what we think the Senate should do, how it should exercise its legislative powers and responsibilities. And this judgment, in turn, depends on an even larger question, how we believe national policy should be made under Australia's constitution or under the constitution of any reasonably democratic regime. So what I want to talk about today, somewhat briefly, are three basic approaches that countries can take. To my mind, one of these models is flawed on both empirical and normative grounds, especially when it's applied in the very sweeping way that its proponents often advocate. I don't think it makes much sense, but I am absolutely certain that on the morning after your election next month, you're going to be hearing a great deal about it. And I'll explain what I mean in a moment. The second of the models I have in mind, to me, is a myth also. And its proponents are in need of, I think, they really are in need of a radical platitudectomy, which I consider to be my finest contribution to the English language during this visit. As you may be guessing, it's the third model that I think is best suited to both preserving and improving the long-term health of my society and perhaps yours as well, but it's also a model that's under threat in my country and perhaps here as well. So let me talk about each of them briefly, maybe not so briefly, and then conclude with some thoughts about the Senate and about legislative decision-making. The first model that I mentioned briefly tells us that government policies must be decided by the majority of representatives who in turn speak for and act on behalf of a majority of the electorate. Now, if all this means is that constitutions prescribe decision-making by majority rule, then this may seem to be little more than a truism. But what I have in mind is a much more ambitious form of majoritarianism, what I'll call mandate majoritarianism, that begins with recognizing the power of a parliamentary majority to work its will, but then goes far, far beyond that and contends that the majority not only has the power to do what it wants, but that it has both the right and the obligation to control parliamentary decisions because that's what the voters expect and that's what the voters demand. In summary, the argument runs something like this, and we see it happening today. As each parliamentary election approaches, as it's approaching now, each of the contesting parties will present a catalog of programs that it will enact and implement if it's entrusted with the power of government. And each of you and every other Australian voter then carefully studies and evaluates all of these catalogs. And you select one of them because you agree with everything it says. And then you vote for that party. And one of the parties will receive a majority of votes, which will translate into a majority of seats in the parliament, or at least in the House of Parliament that monopolizes power or that should monopolize power in the case of a bicameral parliament. The party then enacts into law without substantive change the programs that were enumerated in this electoral manifesto. And once the programs are enacted, of course, the governing party proceeds to implement them in the manner that it deems to be most consistent with the commitments that it made to the voters. The election results constitute a blanket endorsement of the party's program. And this is not merely a grant of discretionary authority to act, because the party is obligated to enact and implement its program, because a failure to do so would constitute a breach of trust with the electorate. The party must do what the people have elected it to do. It's not only been given a mandate to govern, it's been mandated to govern. Now, my core argument is that there's simply very little reason to believe that such election mandates actually exist. And I'll try to make that argument by simply pointing to some of the assumptions about parties and voters that are implicit in this model. And as I do so, I encourage you to ask yourselves whether they're truly characteristic of the parties and the voters that you know. First, these claims of election mandates require that the parties seeking a mandate have to explain to the voters during the campaign just what it is they'd do if they were elected. And in this respect, I think by and large Australian parties do a very good job of it. Certainly, if you compare the documentation that the parties put out in 2004 and that they're in the process of putting out now with the American party platforms that we adopt at our quadrennial presidential nominating conventions and then proceed to forget about the next day. But because Australian voters have to choose among several parties, there are thousands of pages, perhaps, of policy presentation and analysis and explanation that each voter has to absorb. And this presents a dilemma. If the party's manifesto is cast in general terms, and so far that's what I've seen on the Liberal Party website, there can be all kinds of ways to write bills that arguably would implement each of the items in this program. So the voters may know in general terms what the party would do, what kind of legislation to expect, but they wouldn't know the specifics. And in legislation, as we know, as in so many other things, the devil is in the details. On the other hand, if the party platform truly is specific, so specific and detailed that it's possible to translate it without difficulty or ambiguity into the specific legislative language of law, then the problem becomes that the governing party's commitment to fulfilling its mandate leaves it little or no room for maneuver, little or no room to adapt to changing circumstances, even over the course of a relatively brief 3-year period. Mandate claims also have to assume that the voters actually understand and evaluate the various parties' plans and promises. I did a brief radio interview this morning with Alex Sloan on ABC Radio, And she asked me why I thought these mandates didn't make much sense. So I asked her if in 2004 she had actually read everything that the parties had put out. After all, one could assume that she is a much more interested and informed and active voter than most other Australians. And she was quick to acknowledge that she hadn't. Shall I ask how many of you did in 2004? The sheer size of these party documents, with all of their supporting white papers and other documents, give me absolutely unshakable confidence that if similar kinds of documents were presented by American political parties, very few of us would have more than the most vague idea of what's in them. But when the party, the victorious party, now with its election mandate, then insists that one or more of its bills has to be enacted quickly and unchanged, it can point to some paragraph or some bulleted point in one of these documents as proof positive that a majority of voters must want it enacted. Why? Well, the party advocated it during its campaign, and the party won the election. Therefore, it's supposed to follow inescapably that the electorate thereby endorsed that particular campaign promise. A third concern I have is that these claims of election mandates also have to assume that people vote on the basis of their evaluations of what the parties propose to do in the future. And I don't know about Australian voters, but I do know that that is not at all a fair characterization of the American electorate and how and why it votes. Oh, to be sure, voters may prefer one party's general approach on domestic or foreign policy or both to the approach of the other party. But most of us are also influenced, and probably more so, by a variety of other factors. Our family voting tradition, our own longstanding party loyalties, and increasingly in the era of television, how much we like and trust individual candidates. Did you see Kevin Rudd on Sunday afternoon? That was a most presidential speech he made. You know, he was presenting himself, not the Labor Party. I don't think he mentioned the Labor Party. And he kept saying, if you elect me as your prime minister. I expected him to say, if you elect me as your president. But it's an indication of the extent to which voters' choices do become personalized. Now, many voters are strongly influenced in their votes by their very strongly held views on issues, but very often it's on one issue. In the U.S., it could be, abortion, it could be gay marriage recently, or gun control, or immigration, or next year, quite possibly the war in Iraq. And they pay very much less attention to the other issues. Also, our voters frequently vote not on the basis of what they expect to happen in the future, but what's happened to them in the past. A lot of voting is retrospective, based on evaluations of what the party in power has done since it took office, not on what it promises to do in the future. If most voters aren't content with what the government is, how the government has been performing, they're not very likely to be persuaded by its promises of how much better it's going to do in the future. On the other hand, if most voters are relatively satisfied with recent government performance, it's going to be far more difficult for an opposition party to convince voters to vote for them, because what can they offer? Only promises of what they will do and assurances of their good intentions. So, to wrap all this up, it seems to me that the voting behavior of Americans is entirely inconsistent with all the assumptions and the requirements of mandate theory, and I have a sneaking suspicion that much the same may be true of the Australian electorate. So, if this mandate majoritarianism empirically is a deeply flawed model of decision-making, think how much more difficult it is to defend the model when the parliamentary majority doesn't, in fact, receive a majority of the popular votes. When the majority of votes instead, first preference votes, go to the opposition and to other parties and to independent candidates that aren't in the government, and as I recall, that's happened quite frequently in Australian political history. And under those circumstances, what becomes of the argument that the government is both the right and responsibility to enact a program that the majority of the electorate has just rejected at the most recent election? It just doesn't make very much sense to me. And unfortunately, in this case, I'm not, you know, beating a dead horse, am I? What I may say about this and what you might believe, I assure you, won't make a dime's bit of difference. We will still hear those claims of election mandates on the day following the election. So let me turn more briefly to the second model I want to mention, which I think is equally flawed for the same fundamental reason, which is that it makes assumptions and imposes demands that almost all of the time simply are unrealistic. In the United States, we frequently hear our elected officials say that what we need to do is we need to reach a consensus. We need to reach a consensus on how to address whatever the most pressing issue of the day may be. The goal shouldn't be to decide to enact one party's answer to that problem or another party's answer. Instead, what we need to do is we need to bring everybody together. We need to bring the parties in the legislature together and to bring the legislature and the executive together, all in support of a policy decision that we all have come to realize is the right thing to do. As you may gather, I don't put a lot of stock in this approach either. But let me give you one example. From the American Congress early this year, when you may remember or may not, no reason you should, our House of Representatives adopted a resolution suggesting that President Bush's troop surge in Iraq might not be such a good idea. And the Democrats in the Senate wanted to pass the same kind of resolution. One of the key advocates in the Senate emphasized that he and his allies didn't intend in any way to jeopardize the safety and the well-being of the American military personnel who were already in Iraq. Instead, he insisted that his goal, and here I'll quote him, was to enable the Senate, quote, to reach a consensus, and a bipartisan consensus, on how best we go forward with a new strategy in Iraq. Well, I think there's one thing that this assertion has in common with most other references to consensus, and that is they're all nonsense. And I think ultimately they know they're nonsense. I think really what this senator was saying and what legislators frequently mean when they talk about consensus is that we're dealing with a problem which is really tough. And instead of sitting down and doing the hard work of trying to negotiate some kind of agreement, it's so much nicer to talk about how nice it would be if somehow, magically, some answer would emerge on which we would all agree. Because implicit in the notion of consensus is the idea that all members of the group, whether it's a legislature or some other group, or at least the overwhelming majority of them, come to some common understanding as to what's good or what's right or what's the best thing to do. And central to a consensus is the idea that it's supported by all or almost all members of the group and that they support it by choice, not because in any way they're compelled or constrained to do so. And if you think of consensus in this way, I think it almost immediately becomes clear how unlikely it is to find that kind of common ground on almost any major issue of national importance that's going to engage the attention of Congress in Washington or the Parliament here in Canberra. After all, political decision-making rarely is a process of politicians reasoning together until they all agree that there really is a right answer that they've now discovered. And in support of this contention, by the way, I have only to refer to one of America's finest and most distinguished but underappreciated political philosophers, my father, who used to say to me that when two people always agree, it's pretty clear that one of them isn't thinking very much. Now, on any major issue, consensus, I think, is unlikely for several reasons. First, MPs can be expected to have fundamentally different philosophies or ideologies, if you want to call them that instead. What's the appropriate role of government in the society or the economy, for example? Or they may have different understandings of how the world works. They may differ over whether international disagreements are susceptible to negotiated solutions or whether they respond only to the threat of force or the application of force. And third, and more relevant for my purposes here, MPs may disagree because they have constituencies. Under most party and electoral system, MPs represent geographic constituencies. And now I'm going to belabor the obvious. Constituencies are different. They have different characteristics. They also have different needs and interests. And because of these differences among constituencies, many proposed laws are going to affect constituencies in different ways. And sometimes they'll even benefit some constituencies at the expense of others. Politics isn't often a zero-sum game, but especially when money is in tight supply, it can be. So when you hear one MP refer to a colleague by referring to that colleague's constituency, not to his name, as they're often expected to do, one benefit of that is that it's a way of reminding the MP that his colleague who may be disagreeing with him may be taking a contrary position, not because he's dumb or blind, but because he is reflecting and promoting the very real interests of his people, of his constituency. The challenge of lawmaking rarely lies in deciding who's right and who's wrong. Instead, the challenge, I think, usually lies in striking a balance among competing needs and interests, and that's the fundamental problem with decision-making by consensus. A true consensus on important policy is often impossible because it demands agreement on what's right, not on what is the best we can hope to do under the prevailing circumstances. So, having demolished two straw men, and if, as I argue, there are real differences in the interests and preferences within a society, such as yours and mine, and if, as I also argue, the task of government is to strike the best balance among them, then I'll argue that not only is majoritarianism, as I described it earlier, based on claims of electoral mandates, not only can't you support it empirically, but it's not actually such a very good idea at all as a way of promoting the general welfare of the nation. If the governing party claims to have not only the power, but the right and responsibility to work its will in Parliament, then the question doesn't it follow that any concessions that the governing party makes to parties or people who are not in government would have to come at the expense of the government's ability to fulfill its mandate? But what then about the needs of interests of those constituencies whose representatives are not in government? Now, defenders of mandates would argue, I suppose, well, not to worry, we already took them into account as we were formulating our electoral program. And to some extent, I expect that's true. I'm not going to suppose that any responsible party is going to entirely ignore the interests of any significant segment of the population. But what I do question is the notion that the leaders or the members of any party are the ones who are best able to decide what should be done to or for groups in the nation, whether they're regional or economic or social groups or whatever other kinds of groups, whether a party is in the best place to decide what to do to or for such a group if that group has largely opposed the party in government in the past and is very likely to continue to oppose it in the future. We assume, those of us who believe in democratic government, that we as the people are the ones who are best able to determine our needs and interests and to decide what the government should or should not do about them. And when it's impractical, as it is in modern societies like ours, for us to become involved directly to speak for ourselves as the laws are made, we rely on the people whom we elect to speak for us. Well, if all those who next month vote for non-government parties and independents come to believe that once the election is over, they're not going to have much of an effective voice in their government until the next election rolls around, I don't think that's a healthy development. I think that promotes cynicism and disaffection. Instead, it seems to me that long-term social harmony is much more likely to benefit from a generally shared belief that the needs and interests of all segments of the population are being forcefully expressed in Parliament, and that their representatives are able to have at least a modicum of influence over the decisions that are being made in this building. And this finally brings me, to the third of the models I wanted to discuss with you. If mandates and consensus are a myth, then I'd like to argue to you that compromise is a virtue. Now, here I'm juxtaposing compromise against consensus. If the search for consensus is the search for what's right, then the search for compromise is the search for what's best or most generally acceptable under the prevailing circumstances. And compromise requires the governing party to accept some limits on doing what it would like to do, and even on doing some of the things that it has both the numbers and the constitutional authority to do, and to accept these constraints in order to take into account in a legislative manner, not just in rhetoric, the needs and interests of those who voted against the winning party. Now, I don't mean to suggest for a moment that the minority in U.S. terms or the opposition in Australian terms should have as much influence over legislative decision-making as the majority or the government. I'm not that naive, nor do I believe that should be true. But I do mean to say that the long-term interests of the nation, any nation, are best served when the governing party has to ask itself what changes in its legislation it can accept in order to ameliorate whatever detrimental effects it may have on certain constituencies, but without sacrificing the fundamental principles to which it committed itself during the campaign. And if the governing party isn't inclined to accept such compromises as desirable, and that's exactly what I'd anticipate in the real world of politics, then it's good if the nation's political institutions give some person or some entity the power to make the government or to encourage the government to accept some compromise as necessary. So, the last issue I want to address briefly is how compromise is to be achieved. Elected officials in the United States usually have the prospect of the next election always in mind. And if you think your three-year cycle is short, we have our congressional elections every 2 years, and we have had a continuing presidential campaign going on since, I think, 1948, or at least it seems that way. So elected officials are naturally and reasonably anxious to do as much as they can in the time they're given to use the powers of government to promote the policies in which they believe and the values for which they stand. So I admit, therefore, that I don't expect the winners of my elections or yours to voluntarily concede much of the fruits of victory to the losers, whether it be the minority in the United States or the opposition in Australia. So what then can compel the winners toward compromise? Well, in a presidential system like mine, with our competition between the Congress and the President, the Congress is not terribly inclined to simply accept presidential legislative proposals without change. That's so even when the same party controls both branches of government, and it's even more so when there's divided control, when we have a president of one party and the other party controlling one or both houses of Congress, which has been more the norm than the exception during the last half century. And in the U.S., these factors are complemented by a relatively weak system of party discipline and by an electoral system that always encourages our legislators to think first about how their constituents want them to vote and not how their parties want them to vote. So policy compromises become almost inescapable even when compromise is lamented, as it usually is, as a necessary evil, not as a positive good. The problem we tend to have is the reluctance of the members of both parties and both institutions to drag themselves to the negotiating table and start talking seriously, which they ultimately do. It just may take them 6 months or 12 months or longer to do that, and meanwhile, the government may have to shut down for lack of money. 1975 occurred once here. It occurs much more often in Washington. Now, in some parliamentary systems, there are many parties, and none of them come close to winning a majority of the vote, so government coalitions are negotiated after the elections are over, and even then, the government's support in parliament can remain shaky. And in those cases, we're much more likely to find a compromise approach to legislating than we're likely to find in a parliamentary system that has two dominant and highly disciplined parties like we might find in, Bangladesh, for example. Now, the title of my paper speaks of mandates, consensus, compromise, and the Senate. So what does the discussion of the first three of these points have to do with the fourth? Well, for those of you even back up there who've managed to stay awake, I think you'll know the answer is fairly obvious. It's the Senate, when it's had a non-government majority, that has the constitutional power and the political incentives to compel the government to accept some legislative compromises that it would be unlikely to make of its own volition. If the compromise approach that I've been advocating is preferable to the alternatives, and if the House of Representatives is unlikely to be that forum for compromise, not because of any flaw in the House or its members, but because the government has a majority and party discipline is so powerful, then it's to the Senate that we have to turn, and that's largely why I decided to look at the track record of the disposition of the Senate's legislative amendments since Mr. Howard became Prime Minister. So I'll close then where I began. As I said at the beginning, I think there is clear evidence that before July 1 of 2005, that we do see instances in which the Senate strongly encouraged, if we don't want to say compelled, the House of Representatives and the government to accept changes in its bills. I see this in amendments that the Senate sent to the reps disagreed to, rejected, but that ultimately either were accepted or that led to some kind of compromise position that both chambers accepted. But after July 1, 2005, we see very, very little evidence of this. So, has a change in party control in the Senate made a difference? I think so. Has that change contributed to the long-term health of the political system? I fear not. So, thanks very much. I appreciate your attention. We have, about 20 minutes? So I hope I have been provocative in some respects. That was my intention. Perhaps you have some objections, some observations, some questions. I realize this is not a room that's very conducive to conversation, but if you're willing, let's try the best we can. Is anybody awake up there?
Could I ask any questions to get to the side microphones if they can, so that the questions can be recorded? Perhaps I see one question. Perhaps I could start with one, Stan. I don't do this very often. Regular audience will know I don't do this.
This is not a Dorothy Dixer, right?
No, this is not definitely not a Dorothy. There's a certain amount of literature which says that having total control is not only bad for the country but bad for the ruling party and the government. What's your view on that?
The House of Representatives in Washington was controlled by the Democratic Party without interruption from 1955 through the beginning of 1995. And I guess my answer is that Lord Acton was on to something. It was clear that the Democrats in our House of Representatives came to take their power for granted. And I think most observers would agree that in some respects they came to abuse it in the sense of how they undermined minority participation and minority rights through various organizational and procedural changes they made. So I think some alternation in power will help to prevent that. We've had more regular alternations in power in the Senate, and we have seen, for this among other reasons, somewhat more restraint in a new majority trying to flex its muscles. I do have to say, though, that when the Republicans did become the majority in early 1995, at first they said, we are not going to do to the Democrats in the House what they have been doing to us for the last 40 years. And about 2 months later, they started to say, but all we're doing to you Democrats is just what you did to us for those past 40 years. And now the Democrats are back in power, and this is what social scientists call something that's path-dependent. Once you start down a path, it's very hard to turn back and come in the other direction because there are tactical advantages to some of these innovations. It's a destructive spiral.
But what about being able to enact your program by having total control, both houses plus the executive government?
Yeah.
You're then tempted to enact some of the more bizarre features of your program, and this gets you into trouble.
Yeah, this is a question that's a little bit more difficult for an American to respond to because you're presuming our parties have programs. there was a time when that would be full stop. Our parties are considerably more polarized now than they were with the disappearance of the conservative Democratic South and the disappearance of the moderate, not to say liberal, Republican Northeast. But this, too, has become an issue. When you have both houses of Congress controlled by the same party, about the only real power that the minority party has is its ability to filibuster in the Senate. You see, in the Senate, you can't bring a debatable question to a vote. You can't vote to pass a bill if there are senators who still want to talk about it, no matter how long the debate goes on, unless you can assemble a 3/5 vote to stop the debate, and the majority party in the Senate rarely, if ever, controls 3/5 of the seat. So a determined minority in the Senate can generally bring the institution to a standstill. And before this most recent election, where the Senate was, or where the Congress was completely under Republican control, the Democrats in the Senate started to elevate the filibuster into a matter of high constitutional principle that was part of the system of checks and balances because it was the only effective power lever that the National Democratic Party had. This is what I sometimes call a constitutionalism of convenience, just as it'll be interesting to see what the ALP and the liberals have to say about the Senate if the situation next July should be reversed.
My question had no possible application to any other place.
I thought that.
There was a questioner over on my right. Yes, to the microphone. A brief question.
Well, I'm not sure it's all that brief. I'm sympathetic to the general call you have for compromise, but I wish to call your attention, you probably know anyway, that one of the reasons why we had a majority liberal Senate in 2004 was because of the demise of the Australian Democrats, who were exactly the kind of compromising party that you call attention to. Unfortunately, they compromised once too much by being willing to pass the GST, the sales tax, that almost got the Howard government beaten in 1998. And so it sort of seems as though compromise is getting it sort of in the neck. And I would like to see you comment on that.
Well, after that. I guess I'll make two comments. First, politics is a messy business. And second, I'd be a little bit careful about generalizing from a sample size of one. But I do take your point about the demise of the Democrats. Sir?
First, your candid comment in the beginning that a journalist and a presenter on the radio did not read the policies in the last election. If a journalist doesn't do that, what chance does a member of society has? And also, can you think of a way that you can make things easier on the general public? And do you think the Internet has got a part to play in this?
Well, the Internet certainly has a part to play in making information available. And that's the resource to which I turned when I wanted to confirm my supposition that for the 2004 election that Labor and liberals had put out massive policy documents. So you can make the material available. You can make it readily accessible. But people have to choose to find it, and they have to choose to read it. But you have a dilemma. The longer the documents are, the fewer people who are going to read them. But the shorter and more general those documents are, the less value they are for predicting what parties in government will do, and the greater the gap between some general statement like restraining government spending or cutting taxes and a specific bill that's introduced in Parliament, and we're told, well, this is a bill to implement that promise, because there are all kinds of ways in which you could go about restraining government spending or cutting taxes. So, no, I don't have a good solution.
Yeah, we have another question on the right, so to speak.
I got a question that's also related to the Democrats. The Democrats tried to carve out a position where they said they were there to keep the bastards honest.
I'm sorry.
That was their slogan, there to keep the bastards honest. Right. But they then seemed to adopt a policy of keeping the bastards dishonest. What would happen is that the government of the day would sit down and produce a policy document, take it to the electorate, and then we'd have an election around it. So we had a big election around GST. And then they won the election, and then they wanted to implement their policy that had been fully costed. It was, very great detail articulated. And the Democrats turned around and said, well, we're there to keep you honest, but we're not going to let you introduce your reform. And this has happened again and again and again. For example, superannuation surcharge, the government turned around and said, if elected, we will wind back a tax. The Democrats turned around and said, well, we'll keep you honest. You've won the election. We won't let you do what you promised to do. So another model might be to sit down and espouse a balance of power party that sits down and says that we will require a government to enact the legislation. We're not going to impede it. But we're also going to sit down and say, well, if you say you're going to tax, for example, trusts like companies, and you don't follow through on that commitment, we'll agree to allow you to enact your proposed reforms, but we'll tie it into making sure you enact all your promises and not just cherry-pick the ones that, suit you. So there is another model that you could come up where governments who have a mandate actually given the opportunity to enact it, but also required that they enact all their mandates and not just cherry-pick the ones that suit them. And I think that's why the Democrats fell down, not because they compromised per se, but they sort of had this duplicity in their position.
The GST was a matter of some controversy, wasn't it? That occurred before my first visit here, so I don't claim to know very much about it. But as you may assume from what I said earlier, I don't have a great deal of sympathy with your argument, because I don't think that a government can make an empirically valid claim that it does have a mandate to enact everything in its program. Before I could accept that kind of approach, I want to see some opinion data, for example, that gives us some notion of what the Australian electorate actually did know when they cast their votes, and to what extent they cast their votes on the basis of that information earlier this week. I don't intend this to be a filibuster, but it's timely. I went to a seminar at the ANU where Ian McAllister presented some results on Australian public opinion, and this derives from election surveys from 1987 to 2004. Now, I'm not going to show you the pictures or show you the numbers, but either I suggest you get a copy of this from the ANU or take me on faith when I say that among all of these survey results, there's very, very little that would give any support to folks who claim there really is an election mandate out there.
Yep, we have time for another question.
You've referred to, is this on? Yeah. You referred to a tendency towards an increased presidential style of government in Australia. And certainly that same comment has been made in respect to the United States, and I refer particularly to the work of Chalmers Johnson, and where he asserts that what we have in the US is increasingly an imperial presidency, which implies a breakdown in the whole range of checks and balances that are supposed to characterise a republican form of government as supposedly set out by the founding fathers. Now, an important element of this argument, though, is that he also talks about a military-industrial complex, or rather a military-industrial congressional complex, in which, on the basis of looking after their constituencies, as you put it, together with the fact that the military-industrial complex has plants and therefore employment in every state, the Congress is really unable to put pressure on the executive on the matter of foreign policy. Now, most of what you've said has been in terms of very good comments about procedures, but what this argument is saying in respect to the United States and possibly also Australia in a much smaller way is that the breakdown of the system of checks and balances and the rise of an imperial presidency has a serious effect on policy content, particularly in relation to foreign affairs or international politics. That's a further dimension. I'd like you to comment on, I mean, this is a very difficult issue, a very complex issue, but I was wondering if you have a comment on that.
You have opened not one can of worms, but quite a few. And I'm aware of Johnson's work. I haven't read this book, but I know of it. Several perhaps disjointed responses. First, your reference to the imperial presidency. In 1973, 4, where's John Hart? When did Schlesinger write his book? Do you recall? 3? Arthur Schlesinger wrote a book entitled The Imperial Presidency in 1973. We've been there before. Your reference to the military-industrial complex, as I'm sure you know, that evokes memories of President Eisenhower in the late 50s. So the kinds of concerns that you've expressed, either as your own or reflecting Johnson's work, in most part they're not new. The concerns about an imperial presidency are very much tied to the prominence of foreign policy in the debates of the moment. Nixon's imperial presidency was all in the context of winding down the Vietnam War, and I think with respect to Bush, it's in the context largely of the Iraq War. And it is true that there historically has been a considerable reticence on the part of members of my Congress to challenge presidents on questions of foreign policy, both because lives are at stake and because these are issues, frankly, that most of our representatives and senators don't feel nearly as competent to address as questions of domestic policy. So, yes, there does tend to be much greater deference to presidents because it's much easier for members of Congress to stand back and, if things go sour, to say, well, you know, you won't find my fingerprints on it. We did have resolutions with regard to sending troops into Iraq, and those of you who followed American politics may know how some Democratic senators and presidential candidates have had to tiptoe and tap dance around explaining why they've voted the way they did. But Johnson's argument, as you summarize it, teeters on the edge of conspiracy theory, that there is this military-industrial complex that really is controlling decision-making. I think that's much too much of a simplification. It's true that spending on defense, much of it turns into spending that occurs within the United States on military procurement, and that is a wonderful boon for the states and districts where those military plants are located. But what the argument doesn't take into account is instances in which what you have in Congress is competition for those contracts. I remember one case, I forget how many years ago it was, when Congress was about to provide money for some aircraft, I think it was. And there was a heated debate between the senior senator from Washington and the senior senator from Georgia about the merits of two different models for this plane. And it wasn't a coincidence that Boeing is located in Washington and Martin Marietta is located in Georgia. So it's not any kind of monolith controlling government decisions. Anything else?
One last question, if it's very brief.
My question relates to the difference between consensus and compromise, because I think you put far too high a bar on consensus. It seems to me that the idea that people will always be in harmony is, of course, nonsense. But it seems to me the difference is that the American system assumes that you start with your position, you have an interest group, their position's fixed, and then it gets traded off in a complex series of maneuvers through Congress and so on. Whereas consensus, it seems to me, is best typified by systems of proportional representation in lower houses, assumes that while people come in from different places, there is then movement in the process of debate, and they end up with a position that they can at least all live with, if not wholeheartedly support. So it seems to me there is a conceptual difference there between compromise and consensus that you didn't allow for.
And where you have proportional representation, you don't have powerful interest groups. Is that right?
You do, but it plays out differently, and they perhaps end up by being a little more muted than can happen in America, for example.
I think there's some truth to what you say, and I think to an extent it's a caricature about how political decisions are, in fact, made in the United States. Yes, interest groups are influential, but they are they are not the ones who really make the decisions. After all, bear in mind, what interest groups have to offer are two things, information and money. Now, the information is valuable, but if members of Congress receive information from a lobbyist and they discover the information's false, they're not going to listen to them again. So they have a real incentive to tell the truth. They just don't tell all the truth. They tell the part of the truth that supports their position. Well, that's why you need a parliamentary library in an organization like the one I worked for, to always say, on the other hand, the other thing that interest groups have to offer is money. Money is used for campaigns. What's the purpose of campaigns? It's not to raise money. It's to attract votes. So an interest group is only going to have an effect on one of our representatives or senators to the extent that the funds they provide can be used to attract votes. And the senator is not going to say to the interest group, fine, you give me a campaign contribution and I'll vote your way if I know that's going to alienate a significant share of my constituents, because it's just not worth the price. What I'm ultimately most interested in is not the money, it's the votes. So that's one general kind of reaction. With regard to PR, the argument you're making is one that's been made elsewhere. I don't pretend to be an expert under PR. On PR, I've never lived under a PR system. But for those of you who are interested, I commend to you the work of Arent Liphart, L-I-J-P-H-A-R-T, from University of California at San Diego, who has written books on patterns of democracy and what's it called, democracies, in which he makes just this kind of argument. What I think, it's complicated because it depends not just on whether you have PR, but what kind of proportional representation and what kind of party system. And this is why I said at one point that if you've got PR with many parties and none of them approach a majority, well, you could either have a treaty signed between parties before the election, maybe a bit like the Liberals and the Nationals, or a voter votes for a party without any real idea of whether that party is going to end up in government, and if so, who its allies would be. A classic case was for some years in Germany, where you had the CDU and the SPD representing generally the center right and the center left, and in the middle you had the Free Democrats, who really did usually hold a balance of power. But if you were voting for the Free Democrats, very often you didn't know whether you were voting for a coalition with the SPD or the CDU. So I sympathize with the arguments for PR, but first I want to know what kind of PR, and I want to know something more about the political and electoral system in which it's going to be embedded. It's very difficult to predict exactly how it'll work.
Okay, we're running out of time. I should tell you that there's also an excellent piece by Arent Liphart that's published by the Senate Department. Thank you to our lecturer, and thank you also to the questioners. The questions were very good today, I think.
Thank you all for coming.
I think the question is more good.